And 107.5 FM, W298DK Amory. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Daria Aldinger. House Republicans want the audio recordings from President Biden's interview with the special counsel investigating his handling of classified documents. Attorney General Merrick Garland refused, and today the House voted to hold him in contempt of Congress.
The House of Representatives cannot serve as a necessary check on the presidency if the executive branch is free to ignore the House's subpoenas.
Kentucky Republican James Comer. President Biden is in Italy for the G7 summit. The port of Baltimore was fully reopened today, less than 3 months after the collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge. Thousands of flights were canceled or delayed after days of torrential tropical rain across South Florida. Consumer prices rose 0.2% from April to May, the smallest increase in months. The Federal Reserve leaving a key interest rate unchanged for now. This is ABC News.
I'm James Kelly with WLAK News. Your news roundup in quick podcast form. Find it anytime on the WLAK website at lakeair.radio.
Civic Media News, I'm Ellis Saff. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. Former President Donald Trump and current First Lady Jill Biden are both coming to Wisconsin. Jill Biden will be in Green Bay on Thursday to meet with local seniors and launch a new initiative, Seniors for Biden-Harris. Trump will be in Racine a few days later. Our battleground state has been a popular destination for both Biden and Trump in 2024, who will fight to win key points here in Wisconsin in November. Wisconsin ranks number 11 in the nation for kids' well-being. That's according to the annual Annie E. Casey Foundation Kids Count data book. Wisconsin's child poverty rate is down, but Emily Miota of Kids Forward says disparities persist.
Wisconsin remains the worst state in the nation for Black children and families.
Black children in Wisconsin are 29 times more likely to live in high-poverty areas, and they're not doing well on reading tests. Absenteeism is a problem, too. And that's what you need to know. I'm Ella Saff, and this is Civic Media News.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Yesterday on the program, talked about tipped minimum wage and taxes on tips and Trump's great idea that you got to think just came out. Someone said, hey, maybe throw this out. No policy. No ideas. In fact, the Wall Street Journal did a story where they actually reached out to the Trump campaign. And how they reported it is the Trump campaign hasn't provided any additional details. The idea wasn't something that the Trump administration considered or studied during his first term. It was just one of those campaign things that you throw out and hope someone goes, yeah, I'd like to not pay taxes. And what's interesting is, you know, this is one of those moments where you go, do you really believe that the guy who's, abused tip workers throughout his career cares about them? I mean, this is one of those weird moments. Now, for me, throwing this out here, and I said it yesterday on the program, if we do exempt tip wages from taxation, you'll start to see CEOs working for tips. In fact, you know, all their compensation will be considered a tip, so they don't have to pay taxes on it. But it does a whole bunch more. There are a ton of unintended consequences. For instance, if you work in a high-end restaurant where you get tips, You're going to do really well. You work at a fast food restaurant where you're paid an hourly wage, you're screwed. So what it would do is it would push more people into that tipped desperation. Now you ask, a lot of tipped employees, it's feast or famine most of the time. Times are really good, sometimes really bad. I've always been a believer that tips are supposed to be extra. It's not supposed to be your compensation. It's not supposed to be what you live on. And your business model should be paying a reasonable wage to ensure that your workforce can make it in the world. And then that tip that consumers, patrons give them is for a job well done, not as the compensation. And this is where I think we should, thanks to Trump for opening this door, but we should be talking about tipped wages. We should be talking about especially the lower end of the work scale. I've said for years, I think you should exempt all taxation up to about, $40,000. Let's say 40 grand, nothing, you pay nothing in taxes. Everybody, across the board. And then you go up from there. We have a progressive tax scale above that. The more you earn, the higher you pay. This way, you have a secure base where everyone has the opportunity to at least put a roof over their head, put food on the table, all of that stuff. We're not talking about any of this. We're talking about a gimmick that Trump threw out. And the Wall Street Journal did an incredible piece on it. But understand, there's no policy behind this. There's no thought behind this. This was a campaign blurb. This was verbal diarrhea, if you will. There was nothing behind this. And this is my problem with Donald Trump. There are a lot of things that just get thrown out. And we take it as, he must be serious. There must be something behind this. Oh, my goodness. There's a thought. When the reality is probably someone mentioned it to him in the car ride on the way over. And he goes, I'll just throw that out. Again, no policy behind it. This idea that he can do it as president, he can't. He's got to go to Congress. Congress has got to approve this. And then I want to hear Republicans go, how are we going to pay for it? Because that's what they're going to do. But our media, they pick it up and go, what if? Like it's a real proposal. Why don't people just go, wait a second, Donald Trump said it during a campaign rally? That's nonsense. There's nothing. And this is what it is. There's nothing behind this. But it will create division. It will get him some print, as the Wall Street Journal did. You want to do something really strong for workers? How about we fix the tax code? We don't tax people at the bottom, and we tax people at the top, the ones who can afford it. Maybe that's a thought. I want to hear yours. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. How do we help working people? How do we help tipped employees to be able to put food on the table? Is the Trump idea, is that the way to go? Knowing that there's nothing behind it? Rick@therickSmithShow.com. Right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So no surprise here, a new CBS News YouGov poll. They have found out that 80% of Republicans say that they believe that the charges that were brought against Donald Trump by the Manhattan District Attorney, those charges directly from Joe Biden himself. Joe Biden in the basement while coding and doing all the other stuff, he directed the Manhattan prosecutors to go after Donald Trump. And look, nonsense. But 80% of Republicans, now 57% of Americans overall, don't believe it. So again, there's this disconnect. Remember we talked about the other night about the alternative facts thing? First time I heard alternative facts, I laughed. We are now living firmly in the world of alternative facts. And here to share some thoughts on the alternative facts and the big conviction to yesterday of Hunter Biden, I've asked our good friend Bob Ney, former Ohio congressman and political analyst, to come share some thoughts. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick. Alternative facts and an alternative universe considering this election.
Let me ask you about that. I mean, 80% of Republicans today, 80% of your former party believes that directly from Joe Biden these orders came.
Well, I mean, I can understand that. Everybody always thinks that, you know, a sitting president can order this and order that. So I can see where they would blame it. I don't believe it came from Biden, period. But I will say this. I think the prosecutor on his own didn't like Trump. And New York's always been at odds, and Trump's been at odds with New York.
Yeah.
So that doesn't surprise me. So the motivation of the prosecutor himself might be one thing. I don't think Biden ordered it at all. I just think the prosecutor decided, you know, he was going to do it.
Yeah, but again, to me, the number's still surprising that the 80% of Republicans believe that it came. And I guess this is where you go, you know, would they be in favor of Trump, you know, saying to a state, prosecute this person? It's a weird spot we're in. And speaking of states prosecuting someone, Hunter Biden was found guilty on all charges of the gun possession, the form stuff. Any thoughts?
Yes, I looked at this case a little bit different. I think I looked more into the recovery end, more into the addiction end than I did the form he signed. I looked, you know, more towards, where he was at from what I could understand. Now, I remember when he had the plea deal, which, by the way, I would be remiss if I didn't point out that he had a plea deal. It was a great plea deal. I'm going to sound like Trump. Best plea deal ever. You know, it was a great plea deal, and it went up sky high into court last year. This would have been over with, and, you know, there wouldn't have even have been gun conviction on record. Anyway, that was then, and now here we are now. But when I looked at, you know, the witnesses, now he had a daughter testifying for him, but he had, a girlfriend, an ex-wife, et cetera, and Bo's deceased, his wife, testifying about, not against him as much as the situation.
Right.
And when I saw that, I'm trying to think to myself, because I've been in recovery for 18 years almost, and I've sponsored a lot of people that have went to jail, and, you know, they will tell me, well, I was addicted when I was doing it. I didn't know what I was doing. But if you get behind the wheel of a car and you're blind drunk and you don't know what you're doing and you crash into somebody, you pay. Okay. So when I saw the way this case was going, I was looking at the recovery end and how would, if Biden went on the stand, how would he answer? Now, he didn't go on the stand. So I don't think the defense had a great ability to take what was in Hunter Biden's mind years back and translate it into the day he filled that form out. So I don't think there was any, you know, surprises about it. Now, the question is, you know, what the sentence particularly will be. It can be up to 25 years. This is first time offense. I do know personally a guy that smoked one joint 10 years before he filled out his form. He smoked a joint at that time before that. And the feds caught him 10 years later over one joint and sent him to prison for a year and a day. So who knows? That was that courtroom. This is this. That's why I try to tell people, cases are different.
Yeah.
Courtrooms are different.
Judges are different. No.
Judges are different.
And we'll find out what happens when in 120 days when the sentencing comes down. But, you know, the recovery part of this is interesting because I looked at the president's I looked at President Biden's response, and look, it's the response you would expect from a father who, look, you know, we love our son. You know, we're proud of that he's gone through this, and hopefully he's on the other side. It seemed to me to be a genuine, really, the kind of response that you know, any father would have.
Mm-hmm. Well, look, you know, people don't particularly understand addiction if it's the first time it's happened in their family. I've actually written a book I've never published yet, unfortunately, but it's called It's Beyond Stopping. And families don't know where to go. And sometimes they think they're helping their loved one. Maybe it's enabling, maybe it's not. But the point of this is the family sticking by him. And the president and his wife have done that. And that's an important first step because the focus now has to be the recovery. Recovery is an ongoing lifelong process. And now is a particular time when Hunter Biden will really have to focus on maybe recovery meetings. And I'm not taking his inventory, but recovery meetings, recovery process, a sponsor, going through a network. I mean, there's a lot of things, therapists that he may want to particularly do at this time, because unlike a lot of low profile cases, he's a high profile case. Yeah. And people are going to be watching. Does he relapse? They're going to be watching it. Yeah, every day,
for his sake and for the family's sake, I hope gets the help that they need. I got to move on to the next thing. I'm sure you saw the Pelosi tape. Fox News is running crazy. All of the right wing outrage machine is, you know, Nancy Pelosi knew she didn't call out the National Guard on January 6th. It's all her fault. She takes responsibility. So therefore, everything is forgiven. It's all her fault. Release the January 6th hostages. I've heard all the crazy messaging and all of this out of this one tape of Nancy Pelosi clearly flustered, clearly angry, and being, in my view, kind of a leader in the moment going, you know, we screwed this up. We should have done better. I'm curious what your thoughts when you heard the tape were.
Well, this one hit me personally. Because I compared it to 9-1-1. And at the time, with 9-1-1, I was chairman of House Administration. Steny Hoyer, who is still currently in the House, was my ranking member. He was the ranking Democrat. And when 9-1-1 happened, we had a process where we put the Capitol on the highest alert first. I accidentally knew that the plane was hitting the Pentagon before it hit the Pentagon. It was weird. There was a Washington Post article on it. I had an employee, one of our lawyers, who happened to be out at the dentist, and he was stuck by the bridge, and he's on the cell phone saying, I think this plane is heading to the Pentagon, and his name was Hayes. So we were on the phone, and we were on the phone with Hoyer. We were linked at the hip with Hoyer's office, my office, because House Administration oversees the Capitol, me for the Speaker at the time, Hastert, and Steny Hoyer for Nancy Pelosi, the minority leader. And I bring this all up because this is how it works. You don't call with 911 when the planes were flying into buildings. Well, let's have a meeting of the police board, which I've heard that said, the police board would meet. And of course they, you know, the Sergeant of Arms of the House and Senate resigned, but there's a different process how you do it. Now here's what I suspect. And I've never seen this looked into, but I suspect that McCarthy, as you know, at the time as Speaker, and Pelosi's representatives and House Administration didn't have that bond. I'm going to guess this one, but I've never read anything that they did. If they did, they would have pre-planned. Let me give you a couple of more examples, Rick. When Hosni Mubarak was alive, the president of Egypt, anytime he would visit the Capitol, believe it or not, that was one of our highest security risks, Hosni Mubarak. One of the other highest security risks is the Dalai Lama. So whenever they would visit the Capitol, we would pre-plan all types of different, you know, situations. And we did that with Democrats and Republicans and for all high level. So somewhere along the line, when the intel was coming in, House Administration Committee, I would assume the Democrats and Republicans at the leadership level would have started to say, should we have this option? Should we have that option? Now, I think what happened with Nancy Pelosi is pure emotion. When I saw the, you know, the Capitol raided that day, it struck me. When 9-1-1 occurred, I was angry, as Hoyer was, at people trying to, you know, bring a plane into the Capitol to kill. We have 10,000 staff there to kill staff people. You have an emotion and a link to the Capitol where you're not human. And I think what happened with Nancy Pelosi was a total frustration, a breach of the Capitol that we have not seen since the British invaded the Capitol. And she's in the car saying, you know, I take the responsibility. Well, technically, Nancy Pelosi and Speaker McCarthy's, their surrogates and the people that plan these things, you know, would be also responsible. But when it came to the guard, it was a heated emotional moment. She can't call out the guard. They can ask the president. D.C.'s different than Ohio or Pennsylvania or any other state. They would have to ask the president, which we know eventually happened, and he reacts to the Secretary of Defense, who calls out the guard.
Right. But even in Ohio, can the Speaker of your House, can they call out the National Guard, or does that have to come from the governor?
Governor.
Yeah, so this, again, when I keep hearing my red hat friends going on about how, you know, Nancy Pelosi should have had the National Guard there, that's not her job. And to the point that you were making, you know, I always thought that's how it worked, that you in a bipartisan way, you have a committee, you work this stuff out. For me, this just shows just how dysfunctional that operation is. And maybe that's why we're not hearing about it, is because nobody wants to admit just how bad things are in Congress.
Well, yes, because when I saw the breach at the Capitol, and when I saw a statement made that, well, the Capitol Hill Police Board didn't make this call or that call. Capitol Hill Police Board has the Sergeant of Arms of the House, Sergeant of Arms of the Senate, and a couple members on it that aren't even on House Administration Committee, which oversees the Capitol. So when I saw that, I thought, no, the Capitol Hill Police Board doesn't have a meeting. You know, and even in pre-planning for the up to January the 6th, even in the pre-planning, Capitol Hill Police Board wouldn't do anything. It would be the representative for the Speaker, representative for Minority Leader, House Administration Committee, and members, and the Sergeant of Arms of the two chambers. Now, somewhere along the line, I have a feeling probably Democrats and Republicans didn't communicate with each other to set up this entire, you know, process as they should. That's what I'm guessing happened because of the, you know, terrible attitude up on Capitol Hill and the partisanship. I'm assuming that's what happened. But I think Pelosi's reaction is an emotional reaction, and we all have it.
Yeah.
You know, the day we had 9-1-1, Rick, I can't tell you after that how many flaws we had. You had Speaker Hastert and Speaker Pelosi met, and they said to Hoyer and I, set up a committee, keep it small, you all do what you need to do. And I'll give you another example of National Guard that day on Capitol Hill, where there would probably have been resistance anyway in the beginning. And that is the fact that when we had 9-1-1 and anthrax, we put automatic weapons into the hands of Capitol Hill police officers on the steps of the Capitol. Because if somebody runs up with an automatic weapon and you've got a six shooter, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
I had some members, Rick, both sides of the aisle come up and say, we got a bad image, Bob, we got to take them away. And I'm like, no, we're not. We're going to have this to protect the, you know, excuse me, the people in the building.
Right.
So I have a feeling there was also a perception of calling the guard in early might have looked, you know, a bit aggressive.
And then I come back to, why aren't we hearing this from our corporate controlled media? Why does Fox News get to run this kind of a story and make this sound like some great conspiracy that Pelosi and the Democrats wanted this to happen and pushed for this? You know, it's frustrating and it's angering when I hear you explain how things are supposed to work, and then I know it's not happening. I got to tell you, it's frustrating. Finally, I want to get your thoughts on, I'm sure you saw the Alito tapes.
Yes.
More tapes coming out. In this day and age, just you know, it's that old thing that, you know, every microphone you sit behind, make sure you know, think that it's a hot mic. I guess in this day and age, anybody you're talking to, think of that as a hot mic, because, you know, Alito did. He spoke candidly about what he saw as the ideological battle on the right and the left. on the court, and this idea of fundamental differences that they can't be compromised and all this. Any thoughts on Alito's comments?
Well, if you're a councilman, by the way, in the local community, and you go down to get a donut in the morning and somebody says hi to you, assume you're being taped.
Yeah.
Okay. It's America now. And I looked at Alito and I looked at Roberts, Chief Justice Roberts, and his response to basically the same type of thinking. And it was, you know, planets apart. Alito looked like, and this is my real criticism of him, looked like he may have wanted to answer the way he did or may not have. He sort of didn't have the guts to just say, wait a minute, here's our role, I disagree with you. He said, yeah, I agree with you about having God in our country. And Roberts, I'm going to paraphrase here, but basically said, I don't think you want me to be the moral compass. You know, we're lawyers. That's how we're supposed to respond, is to the law. So it shows, obviously, at least for Roberts, who answered correctly, and it shows for Alito that Alito is somebody who is ideologically driven to the point as Chief Justice, he should know better than to make that type of statement. Now, he can say, I believe in God, but there's a process, and that process is the court and legal definitions and legal arguments. I mean, he could have said that, and yeah, he didn't.
Now, look, I know Lauren Windsor. I know the person who got the tape, and mm-hmm. I like her. She does good work. But, you know, this is one of those moments where, didn't we already know this, though? I mean, Alito's been the guy who's been the most outspoken, and especially in arenas like this you know, Supreme Court Historical Society annual dinner and other speeches that he's given. Maybe not this blunt and to the point, but, you know, I think didn't we already know this?
Well, yeah, look, judges are supposed to be at every level. They're not supposed to be hermits, but they are always supposed to be at a caution level of blending their personal feelings and opinions into the courtroom, or giving even the perception.
Yeah.
If he says, you know, yes, I agree we need more God in the country, that's a personal view. But stating it makes one at least think, is he going to bring that into his decisions? You know, he states it out. He has no fear to state it.
Yeah.
It's somewhere in the judicial process, judges need to, you know, have a certain amount of non-political or non-ideological thinking. They may have it, but it's sort of like, keep it to yourself.
Yeah.
Know?
And maybe don't fly the flag out in front of your house. You know, maybe don't, you know, maybe don't feed into that political partisanship just because it looks bad for the court.
Well, and also, you know, the flag thing, I can judge myself this way, but it's really a lack of control. You know, you get mad at your neighbor and she's the spouse of a Supreme Court justice. I'm going to get him. I'm going to fly the flag and there's nothing he can do about it. I mean, it's just sort of ideology gone rampant.
How would you like to live next door to that nightmare?
I was just thinking that the war of the neighbors, you know, it kind of reflects back in my mind to Rand Paul and the neighbor that tackled him. And there was something going down between those neighbors before he got tackled.
That's a long going battle.
Yes.
But you know, look, the Supreme Court right now has got its problems. I mean, you got Clarence Thomas who, you know, every time I turn around, there's a new story about how many millions of dollars he's taken in gifts. His wife is a disaster for the court as well, out there pushing all of the MAGA stuff, all of the Tea Party stuff. You know, what is it with these justices and their wives? I mean, look, I want a nonpartisan court. I want people who are going to follow the law. You know, Roberts said that he agreed with the idea of stare decisis, decided law, and this court has done their foolhardy best to throw out the idea of decided law. In fact, I'm hearing rumors, and maybe you're hearing this too, that here at the end of the month, when the term ends and all the cases have to come out, it's going to be an onslaught of bad decisions. In fact, so many that we're probably not going to get to them all.
Yeah, it may be a busy court season. The other thing that disappoints me, I guess, institutionally, is the fact that the Congress has got to get some guts one day. The Congress as a whole, House and Senate. And, you know, they have the power to pass the ethics reform bill for the Supreme Court. They have the power to do it. And this walking on kid gloves. Yeah, these are the Supreme Court, but, you know, this is these are not the supreme beings. And somewhere along the line, Congress has got to say, fine, you got your opinion and you have your opinions you exert on our laws, but we're going to pass a law on how you're going to live within ethic constraints, I think.
If you can't act right, we're going to make you act right.
We're going to make you. That's a good point.
There you go. Bob, as always, great stuff. Appreciate the time.
Thank you.
Our good friend Bob Ney. Want to hear your thoughts. I hear a lot of people talking about term limits. I'm against term limits, top to bottom. But I want to hear your thoughts. What do we do with our Supreme Court? Quick break. Right back.
You're listening to Lake Air, WLAK, Amory's home for Up North News Radio.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Scattered showers and thunderstorms this evening. Some could be severe with large hail, damaging wind gusts, and an isolated tornado. Partly cloudy and a low in the mid-60s overnight. Sunshine in low 80s tomorrow with a slight storm chance. Mostly sunny Friday, highs near 80, more rain possible this weekend. It's 69 degrees right now.
100 days, 144,000 minutes. The countdown to the November presidential election is on, and Maggie Dawn is counting too as she continues her special segment, Biden's Top 100.
Having heard from each and every one of you, I should start talking about what President Biden is proposing us for his second term.
Biden's Top 100 continues. You're invited to be part of it too. Call or text the Maggie Dawn Show, weekdays starting at 2, across the Civic Media Radio Network and the app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I am going to fill up your summer reading list really quickly. On Monday, we talked about the wolves of K Street, you know, all of the moneyed interests that have gone into taking over our democracy and our government. You know, the best democracy money can buy. One end of the political spectrum. The other, labor history. One of the things that I'm extremely passionate about. Anyone who listens to the program has heard our labor history in two. Know it's something that we push. But I came across this book, Shift Happens, The History of Labor in the United States. And I said, this is somebody we got to come and talk to. That's why I've asked Jay Albert Mann to come talk with us. She's a disability activist and award-winning author for young people. And Shift Happens, well, just happens to be for young people. And look, me too. Jay Albert, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks so much for having me, Rick.
So let's start with this. Shift Happens. Great title. What made you come up with it?
Well, when you're writing for young people, you really want to capture them. And of course, you know, being a little bit of fun, that's always going to capture people's attention.
Now, this is the history of labor in this country from, well, Christopher Columbus until just the other day, isn't it?
Yes. So, right. So I start with Christopher Columbus when he hits the shores of the Bahamas. And I take us all the way up through the stand-up campaign of the United Auto Workers in 2023. So it's a pretty comprehensive history. The one thing I really, well, two things I was doing was I was giving American history in context, and I did it through the point of view of working people. So how working people have lived in this country since before it was this country.
What made you write this? I mean, you know, look, I'm a labor guy. It's my passion. It's something that I've tried to help promote. What made you you jump into the middle of this?
I mean, first, it was something that I would like to have read myself, and I was kind of out there looking for. I'm an armchair labor historian, and I was always looking for kind of the base level. So if people were like, hey, what is the history of the working class? That and I really wanted it in, you know, contextualized inside of history. I didn't want it in these like spots of just here's these big labor moments in isolation away from the actual history that people are living every single day. So that's, I think, the first reason I wrote it. And the second is I write historical fiction. And although my books are about different events, the Revolutionary War, eugenics, women's healthcare, they all have a similar theme of equity. And of course, they all, equity is just a something that's really important to me. And it, you know, the inequity that's going on in our country is so upsetting. And so it was the second reason I really wanted young people and anyone, any working person who's interested in their own history should read this book. It's a pretty fantastic history.
No, for me, everything comes from the labor that you endeavor in. You know, we work so that we're able to live. And the history of that work, I think is really important, especially the abuses of the past, so that maybe we learn from the past and maybe don't have to repeat it in the future.
Absolutely. And in the book, I do mention that, yes, we hear that saying a lot. If you don't know history, you're doomed to repeat it. But I say in the book that oftentimes the people in power absolutely know history and they're repeating it absolutely on purpose. And so as working class people, we have to know our own history so we can stop that, you know.
You're spot on. And, you know, they use it as a playbook. We should be using it as something to maybe not do again. And what I love about this, and look, you know, it's become my favorite bathroom book, and I know it shouldn't be, but it's short chapters, real quick reads, and right to the point. Not a lot of extra verbiage, not a lot of flowery filler language. It's straight to the point, and that's what I like about it. That direct, right to the point, quick. Get me in, get me out, get me what I need to know.
And I would say that, you know, I write for young people, and that's how young people would like it. But it's also how I like things, too, especially when I'm taking on a subject that I'm not wholly familiar with. You know, you want an overview. And then later, you know, I have a hefty bibliography of all the different sources that I've pulled from. Many of them scholars, labor scholars, but also many of them fantastic journalists doing great work. And you could use that bibliography not only to learn about the past, but also to follow, you know, as we head into the future. Those journalists are out there working, and a lot of them are working for, you know, they're not working for the Post or the New York Times. They're working for like the Real News and other news sources that working people should also know about.
Yeah, I do plan on stealing some of your bibliography, just so you know, because, you know, look, we do labor history in two, and it's one of the things, you know, it's well-researched, it's well-noted, it's something that it's going to give me some direction, and I'm going to throw that out as a compliment. I hope you take it that way.
Oh, absolutely, Rick. Absolutely. I mean, it would be thrilling to be stolen from. I would be thrilled. For me, you know, of course, like I wrote this book, I find it extremely important that working people know our history. I think it's the only way that we're going to change things. We're the most powerful group on the face of the earth, and we've been being pulled apart through what I call the pyramid of oppression in the book, where we're stamped as women, black folks, white folks, disabled folks. You know, we're pulled apart and then we're stacked on top of each other, and we're made to kind of do a lot of infighting within us, within ourselves. And I would love to point that out, because it's really promoted by the commercial press, this, you know, identity. And you know, and the only thing that's going to bring us together is the fact that we are all the same. We all work for a living.
No, you're spot on. And you know, one of the things we say here on the program all the time is the only way I see us reuniting this country is if we reunionize, because it is the one thing, black, white, Hispanic, however they slice and dice us, you know, white collar, blue collar, pink collar, ring around the collar, however they slice and dice us up. This is what could bring us back together. So learning this history, learning about those divisions, and maybe how we bridge them, a pathway forward, I think.
Oh, absolutely. And just how, you know, to understand the cycle that they've put us in, and the control that they have over us through, you know, the commercial you know, the commercial press. I mean, I think it's something like six companies now or eight companies own 90% of the media. That's a lot of control.
Yep.
And to break out of that, you know, we have to understand the words they use and, you know, the verbiage and, you know, kind of what they've done to us so that they can keep controlling.
Well, I mean, the reality is, you know, some of the things we've been talking about here, you know, I don't know if you've noticed, I look at Iowa, I look at a lot of red states right now, they're undoing child labor protections. They're going after child labor laws because we want those kids back in the workplace, get those kids back in the mines and the mills and the meatpacking plants because they got small hands. They can do intricate work. And again, you know,
and they're cheap.
Of course, they're cheap and exploitable, and they're not going to ask too many questions. And this is where learning our history, maybe we go, let's not do that because it's bad for children.
Absolutely. And then they sell it by saying, I mean, right now unemployment is really low. So, of course, like, you know, we're going to have a little more power as working people. And so how to diffuse that power is to bring in more workers. And at this, you know, there's two ways to do that. Send labor abroad someplace else. Or start, you know, bringing in kids, so 16-year-olds, 15-year-olds into, you know, longer hours, more dangerous jobs, and then they sell it that they're going to learn, well, they're going to learn what values? They're learning in school. Leave them in school for two more years, yeah. You know? They can do a lot of learning there, and then they can, guess what, be out in the workforce with the rest of us for the rest of their lives. So I really do think leaving them alone for 2 years is not such a big deal. But of course, it is when you have a lot of cheap labor out there to, you know, to take advantage of.
Or 4 years, because you look at some of the stuff in Iowa, they're letting 14-year-olds drive to work. So that's a problem. The book Shift Happens, The History of Labor in the United States by J. Albert Mann. We'll get links out on social media how you can pick this up. Highly, highly suggested for your summer reading list. What anything in here that, you know, as an amateur historian, as you said, anything that you researched that you went, wow, that's shocking. Anything that jumped out at you, maybe a little teaser in there for a nugget for people to find?
I mean, gosh, I think there's so much shocking things in there that it's like so numerous. But I think the thing that gets me about labor history the most is really just how dangerous it is to work for a living, how dangerous it's been in the past to work for a living. And if we don't keep on it, if we don't, you know, stop the cycle, that it could be that dangerous again. And so I think that's the most shocking thing. In 1904 in New York City alone, 27,000 workers died on the job. So 27,000 workers. And I know that maybe kids or someone sitting at home would say, oh, well, that was 1904. Well, if we don't stop things like what you're talking about with child labor, that number right now is actually increasing. So from 2010 until now, more workers have been dying on the job than previously. So, you know, I find that interesting. We need to come home at night to our families. We need to come home at night.
Ultimately that. And you know, but beyond, you know, just being safe, being rewarded for your work, having dignity in the workplace, having some type of value to yourself, I think all important as well, because I believe there's dignity in work. And it should be respected. And sadly, I think we're in an era right now where that dignity and respect has, well, been abused.
Absolutely. I cleaned bathrooms at McDonald's for 5 years. And, like, I heard some CEO the other day, like, well, how much do they want for cleaning a bathroom? And I just think they should be the highest paid. You know, a clean bathroom is not only healthy, but it's a joy. It doesn't matter what job you do. You're absolutely right, Rick. There is dignity in all jobs, and even calling jobs skilled or unskilled, it takes skill to do every single job.
Anything in here you found humorous? Anything that made you chuckle? Anything that made you go, "Hey, this is good." I mean, because we can look back at history and point out all the negative stuff. Anything that you said, "Hey, this is a positive."
I mean, I think that I try to focus on the community more than I do the people, but there's just some characters in this book that you just have to fall in love with. And, you know, people like Eugene V. Debs and, you know, Mother Jones, who like is 90 years old and showing up at a strike and being thrown into jail. Like, it's some of the characters in this Big Bill Haywood and even Sean Fain makes an appearance. Like, I think, I don't know about funny, but I do think that these people are heroes and they warm my heart. And so I would say that's very special. Some of the folks I point out in this book.
What are you hoping young people take from this? I think adults should read this as well, because there's a lot of information that, look, most people my age don't even know. Probably don't know 3/4 of what's in this book. So reading a book for a teenager at a teenager level, you know, might be a good read for an afternoon for an adult as well. But what are you hoping young people take from it?
I think civic competence, just how important civic competence is, that, you know, math skills, science skills, reading comprehension, this is all really important, but so is engaging in our democracy, and it's exciting, and it's a responsibility, and I hope that they read it and think, wow, like, I need to get involved, and I think young people today really want to be involved, and so I think that's what I would love, that they read this book and say, yes, I'm going to step in. I'm going to be a citizen of this country.
This is an awesome book, I got to tell you. I love it. I hope people will take a look at it. Shift Happens, The History of Labor in the United States by J. Albert Mann. We'll get links out on social media how you can pick it up. Powell's Books is a place where you can go, obviously, to get it. But J. Albert Mann, I appreciate you taking time for us. Great stuff. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again.
Anytime, Rick. Thank you so much for having me.
Again, the book Shift Happens. And you know what? The challenge is, every union member watching this, you should be buying this for your children. This is how you can pass down that legacy. And oh, by the way, maybe get one, give it to school, the local library. Maybe we distribute this so that people learn a little about labor's history. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1904. That was the day that 18,000 workers in Chicago's stockyards went out on strike. Work in the stockyards was often brutal and dangerous. Thousands of workers toiled in the yards, many of them immigrants from Eastern Europe. They worked butchering and processing the hogs and cattle raised in the American West into meat for distribution by rail to consumers across the country. The industry gave Chicago the nickname Hog Butcher for the World. In 1904, the Amalgamated Meat Cutters Union organized a strike. The main demand was increased wages. The meatpacking companies were able to get scabs to cross the picket lines and act as strikebreakers. Most were African Americans and European immigrants. Many of these workers had not been organized by the union, which was dominated by the skilled German and Irish packing house workers. Novelist Upton Sinclair visited the stockyards during the strike to research conditions faced by the workers. In his famous novel, The Jungle, Sinclair gave a fictionalized account that captured the devastating impact of the scabs on the strike. He wrote, quote, "Such were the stockyards during the strike, while the unions watched in sullen despair, and the country clamored like a greedy child for its food, and the packers went grimly on their way. Each day they added new workers and could be more stern with the old ones, could put them on piecework and dismiss them if they did not keep pace." It was not until the 1930s when the stockyard unions took seriously the task of organizing across race, ethnic, and skill lines that they finally won a contract and gained the rights of union recognition. Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So the book Shift Happens, The History of Labor in the United States. Make sure you find this book. Give it to a young person. Maybe read it yourself. Highly suggest on the summer reading list. I'm enjoying it very much. And again, the idea of learning where we've come from, so maybe we don't screw it up in the future. So Politico article caught my attention. It seems Republicans are back on the campaign trail, taking credit for things that they didn't do. The bipartisan infrastructure bill, in which I don't know why they keep calling it bipartisan. There are only 13 Republicans in the House that voted for it when the majority did not. The vast majority of Republicans did not. But that's not stopping some of them from taking credit. And you look at the person who is the representative in Iowa's first congressional district, Marionette Miller Meeks, who her district, huge money going there. Something like $298 million already of the $470 million that are going to that district. Out there taking credit for, look how wonderful. You know, I was against all of that other spending, you know, for everyone else. But this, that makes me look good, all in favor of. In fact, my congressman, Scott, pardon me, Perry, there's a boatload of cash coming in to his district as well. Some $124 million already spent. Some $432 million allocated for his district. Again, a guy who was never going to support it. But his district is going to benefit from it. And this is one of those moments where I go, you know, I'll be honest. You know, maybe the Trumpian, very Machiavellian way of doing things is maybe that's what we have to do on a certain level. Now, I understand, you know, look, Biden's all about good governance, all about building the entire country, even people who don't agree with him. And look, Scott, pardon me, Perry, most certainly not one of those people. So again, I think you got to keep pointing out the fact that, you know, people like Nancy Mace, who's getting a boatload of money into her first congressional district in South Carolina. Maybe you keep pointing out that you voted against it, and all of the Republicans except for those 13 who are mostly gone now because they were just wiped out by the Republicans. How could you be a traitor and side with them for the good of the country? How dare you? Quite remarkable. I saw an interesting story over at Bloomberg I wanted to talk a bit about. Evidently, IKEA was having a hard time keeping employees. You know, we've heard for a while that, you know, people who aren't happy in their jobs are leaving, finding other jobs. And I've been saying all along where if you want to maintain a stable workforce, if you want to keep your employees, pay them well, treat them well, give them decent benefits, give them a reason to stay. Well, evidently, the Swedish corporation, IKEA, who was losing a bunch of people, and it was costing them like $5,000 per employee to replace them. Evidently, they thought, hey, maybe what we should do, what Rick says, pay them better, treat them better, give them better opportunities, subsidize their childcare, give them more flexible work schedules, do some things to make them, oh, I don't know, happier. Because happy employees tend to want to stay. Employees that don't worry about where their kids are going to be at tend to want to stay. People who can put food on the table tend to want to stay. People who have decent health care and decent retirement security, the opportunity that if they work hard, they play by the rules, they get ahead, they tend to stay. I know, it's remarkable. Who would have thought, you know, that it would work? You know, I've been saying this, been saying, hey, you know, maybe try this. Well, the Swedish retailer, IKEA, did. And what they found? People are staying. Who knew? Who knew that people who were paid well, treated well, and valued would actually want to stay? Wow. Quite remarkable. And finally, I got to talk about this because the U.S. Department of Labor is putting out their final rule on raising the minimum salary levels that get you exempt from overtime. On the Fair Labor Standards Act, there's a white-collar exemption. And that says, look, you know, if you make a certain amount per week, per year, you're exempt from overtime. So if you work 10 hours or 100 hours, you get paid the same salary. During the Obama years, it hadn't been raised in a while. They raised it from the $23,660. Yeah, $23,660. They wanted to raise it up to $47,000. A little over. There's $47,500, I believe it was. And immediately the lawsuits came fast and furious, stopped it until the Trump administration came in. And they crushed that and said, well, we got to do something because it'll make us look like ogres and it'll make us look bad. So they raised it from $23,660 up to $35,000. And to be honest, that left millions of people without protections and without overtime. And so the Biden came in, the Department of Labor said, hey, we're going to look into this. We're going to make new standards. And they have come up with a new threshold. And as of July 1st of this year, that new threshold will rise from $35,500, some change. I think it's $684 a week, up to $844 a week, or $43,888 a year. In 2025, on July 1st, that number will jump even higher, up to $1,128 a week, or $58,656. For the simplified exemption, for the high earners, for the big wigs, that on July 1st of this year will increase from $107,000 up to a little over, almost $133,000. And then next year on July 1st, up to $151,000. So for the upper folks, that threshold's much higher. But for your local fast food restaurant manager, for your local retail manager, for people who have been given a nice cute little tag, says assistant manager or manager on it, you're now going to get some overtime protection, or you're going to make a decent amount of money. And I've been talking about this since, before the Obama folks came out and said, hey, we should raise this, because we should have been raising this decades ago. In fact, it should have kept up with inflation from the 70s forward. When reality is, in order to get to this threshold, you were making decent money. You were making good money for the time. 23,660, back in the 70s and 80s was a good living. And it had, thanks to Reagan, thanks to the Republicans who have stopped all this, it stagnated. So now Biden's trying to kick this up. Now, here's the thing. You don't have to pay your workers $1,128 a week. You don't have to pay them the $43,888. You don't have to pay that. But you do have to pay them overtime after 40 hours. So you don't get to cheat working people out of hours of their lives. And this is a good thing. So how do Republicans respond? Well, we know corporate America, a slew of lawsuits. But how do Republicans respond? Well, last week, the Republicans filed a resolution of disapproval under the Congressional Review Act. This could nullify this. Representative Tim Walberg, Republican of Michigan, and 40 other Republicans joined together, co-sponsored the resolution on last week on Friday. No Democrats have signed on to it. In the Senate, you got Mike Braun, the Republican from Indiana, leading the way there. Now, is it gonna happen? Probably not, because Biden would have to sign off of it. I doubt he's going to veto something that he's in favor of. But it goes to show the messaging, because this is a messaging vote. This is who's on the side of low wages, who's on the side of corporate America. And I got to tell you, it's pretty remarkable that you've got that many Republicans in this day saying, yeah, I want my name attached to making sure that workers don't get decent wages. Now, like I said, employers don't have to pay those higher limits. They can choose to work people 40 hours, pay them an hourly wage. In fact, you could pay them $7.25 an hour, because that is our minimum wage. But you don't get to work them 100 hours without paying them overtime. And for me, that's the point of all this, and the good point. And again, there's so many things that this administration is moving forward on to make workers' lives better that our mainstream corporate-controlled media, they never follow up on. But this is one of those things. Just one more in a long line of things that I think this administration is doing right. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. What do you think? rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program? Make sure you grab the podcast. Or if you get your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@thericksmithshow.com.
You're listening to Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK Amory and 107.5 FM W298 DK Amory, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.